What's happening across Connecticut? Melissa in the Morning's conversation with Governor Ned Lamont. Now on WICC 600.
Hey, Governor Lamont. Thanks for stopping by. How are you?
Hey, Melissa. Been a while. Nice to hear your voice.
I know. Right back at you. How are you feeling after that first COVID shot?
No, I feel great.
Good.
You know, it takes a little bit of a load off your shoulders. There's no soreness or, I'm feeling good.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Really glad to hear that. Actually, I'm going to kind of shift away from COVID because I feel like for the last year, that's all you and I basically talk about. But I do have one quick COVID question from one of our listeners that I wanted to get to before we move past COVID to some big legislation happening in Hartford. Somebody had asked if you could just clarify really quickly. We know we're in the 65 to 74 age bracket right now to get the vaccine. The next part of this phase is going to be, we've heard, essential workers and those with underlying conditions. But yesterday it was a little confusing. I don't know if it's because you were specifically addressing teachers who wanted to be bumped up in line. But are those with the pre-existing conditions, are they still with essential workers to be the next in line to get the COVID vaccine, or have they been bumped back?
No, no, no. They are right there alongside essential workers.
Okay.
We're going to probably make the announcement on Monday detailing, following the CDC, you can look it up on the Center for Disease Control, who are those essential workers, teachers across, front and center there, and which of the underlying conditions do you prioritize? Because there's, 800,000 people, everything from mild diabetes to cancer.
Sure.
And you got to be careful about how you roll that out. We're talking to the hospitals about that today.
Okay, so we'll have that, more clarity on that, but they're all bunched together in the next part of this phase. That's good to know, and we'll keep an eye out for that. Okay, awesome. So I have a couple of things I wanted to dive into this morning that are not really COVID-related. It's more just state-related stuff. First of all, this is going to sound probably out of left field, but I had asked a couple of our senators this week, and I haven't gotten a straight answer yet. Do you know how much of Connecticut is made up of middle-class families?
I think most people think of themselves as middle class. So it's complicated to say what that is. Is it between 50 and 150,000? You can say 250,000. You're working hard to stay ahead in this game. But,
right.
What I can tell you is it ought to be bigger. We have a middle class, I think, that's getting shrunk, that's gotten hit. And that's why we're doing everything we can to hold down taxes and make education and healthcare more affordable.
Okay. Because I will say, Governor, that, obviously you're going to have, some who agree with some of the things that are going on, some who don't. Obviously, that's democracy. But I have gotten a lot of questions, especially from our listeners in Fairfield County, especially, that have said, I don't know how I'm supposed to afford to stay in Connecticut. Like at this point, I don't know how I'm supposed to stay here. And I'm just not sure, especially because you have a background in business and everything. What do you see with Connecticut's future? Do you worry that we'll see a mass exit of residents at this point?
I can tell you for the first time in 10 years, we had a mass group of people moving to the state of Connecticut, probably 50,000 people in 2020 alone. And that's going to continue because a little bit of the Connecticut lifestyle. Look, we are an expensive state, no question about it. But our housing is a lot less expensive than Boston and New York. So we have some people coming there. And our education system's really good, so you can send your kid to a public school and generally get a pretty darn good education. That saves you money compared to Texas, where maybe you don't feel quite as comfortable doing that. So, but I understand we got to do everything we can to make Connecticut affordable. And my budget really focuses on education and healthcare to hold down those costs because those are two of the biggest hits, along with housing, that hits a middle class family.
Totally. Especially if we're trying to retain kind of my age bracket, the people who are post college, they're in their first 10 to 20 years, just trying to start families, settle down, find solid jobs here. I mean, we want to retain. And also, I do think we're seeing some of our older population still go south. Part of that is because we're in New England, but part of it, I'm sure, is because it's expensive to live here. So, yeah, I like all of that. Now, I'm glad that you brought up the budget.
Some of the older population continues to leave. They left, they've done that for 100 years.
Right.
But it's a lot of younger families who are moving to the state. I love that. They're coming into our schools. I was talking to one of the big developers down in Stanford yesterday. He said one thing that's ironic about these groups, none of them have a car.
True.
And they need a workspace so they can work 3 days a week out of the apartment complex. So it's a changing dynamic.
No, that's very true. Speaking of your budget really quick, Governor, I did notice in your budget address, there were a couple of things that I think we're looking to kind of help us financially, one of which is a federal bailout. I'm just curious because the one thing that I loved in the very beginning of the pandemic was you were super transparent with all of us. You said, look, we're waiting for the feds to help us with PPE. It's not happening. You know, the stockpile, everything. So I'm curious why the shift to thinking that we'll get a federal bailout. If we've seen the feds, unfortunately, leave Connecticut hanging, as well as many other states for that matter, why rely on them now?
I guess a couple of things. One, they are providing all the support, a lot of support as regards, you know, it took them a year to catch up on PPE, but on the vaccinations, on the testing, we're getting financial support there. They just passed a big bill in December, which is going to provide significant support for our schools, probably an additional $200 million a year. So I don't know about relying upon them, but they are putting in place a bridge to when we get this economy going again and everybody's back on their feet. But that, you know, could take a year to dig out from under COVID.
Mm-hmm. And also next door to us in Massachusetts, I saw this morning and I thought, I wonder if Governor Lamont is on board with something like this. Governor Baker in Massachusetts is commissioning a study to see long-term effects of remote working. I thought that was really cool, actually, because especially as like a young mom, paying for daycare is insane. So I don't. I'm very lucky. My mom lives a couple towns over and they take my son a lot of times. But for a lot of families, being able to remotely work has been great. But I know employers are sometimes very old school and they don't know if it's as successful, effective, things like that. Would you debate doing a study like that to see if more companies or organizations should consider remote learning and cut down on costs for young families, especially?
Yeah, Melissa, I'm not sure, you know, you need the government to do a study, but I can tell you that I've talked to a lot of businesses. And for the first 6 months or so, the idea of telecommuting was a big win. And not only was it a big win for that young family or that mom that could spend a little time closer to home, didn't have to spend 45 minutes a day commuting in each direction. But, you know, there's also a same thing has happened to the students. If you're remote all the time, there is a certain sense of isolation. So we're trying to figure out that balance of you also got to get to the office. You got to have the water cooler. You learn a lot from your peers doing that. So I think businesses are trying to figure that out. And I really want to look at the schools, you know, a year of remote learning for those kids. That impacted different kids in different ways, but generally it was a step backwards, and that's why that's such a priority in our budget.
Yeah, no question. I want to talk a couple of things here, Governor. First of all, this week there was a public hearing, as you know, looking at the religious exemptions for vaccinations. You and I have talked about that before, and I think it's important to look at a lot of people who have used that as an excuse and to kind of scale back on that and maybe have something required for it. The thing that I was curious about, I noticed that both with this public hearing and also with the hearing on the public option, there were time limits, a 24-hour time gap that meant that we couldn't hear from about 800 people who wanted to talk about this bill. Same sort of thing that we saw, like a very quick turnaround for the public health option. These are really big decisions. And I'm curious, is that typical that we put time caps on things, or why did we do that?
Well, the legislature did that. What I can tell you is they heard from hundreds and hundreds of people. I guess they could have kept the hearing going for another couple of days. They went round the clock for the vaccination one. They did ask everybody else to submit their commentary by email or letter. But, you know, more broadly, when it comes to vaccinations, Melissa, you know, I got vaccinated at First Cathedral, an African-American church in Bloomfield. I was there with ministers as well as other leaders in the African-American community. I'm doing everything I can to convince people how important it is that you get vaccinated. So it was a little ironic that at the same time there was this hearing going on down the street saying that don't can't make me get my kid vaccinated.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, and I do think my understanding is I think at this point there's only two religions that do not believe in vaccinations. So like I said, I do think there's somewhere there where we need to address it because we do have thousands of children not vaccinated. So I'm just wondering if there's like a compromise there. Like, do you get a written note from your, I don't know what you'd call it, a pastor or priest. I'm not sure the two religions that don't believe in it. But do you get your facility leader to write your child a note instead of just checking the box, hey, religious exemption? Like, is there a compromise there versus just getting rid of it altogether?
Probably the best compromise is make sure the medical exemption works so that if there's anybody that's at any risk at all from getting the vaccination, you have a medical exemption, you don't. But for the other 99%+ of people, getting the vaccination not only keeps you safe, but it keeps your classroom safe, your teachers safe, and your community safe. So let's see how it plays out. But, you know, I'm focused on voluntarily getting as many people vaccinated for COVID as I can, as soon as I can.
Mm-hmm. No, I know. And you've been very, very open about that, which I appreciate. Talking to Governor Ned Lamont this morning, I wanted to talk about the public option. This is something I've been very passionate about. I've been following it. I read through the 35-page bill. I had a couple of questions about it that haven't really been outlined too clearly. So I just wanted to bring your attention to it because I'm not sure what the legislature is going to decide on. But first of all, customer experience. It looks like the bill kind of alludes to having the exchange managed, kind of manage the entire customer experience when we're already understaffed in so many other areas for our local government. So, you know, who's going to manage the thousands of people if they go to this public option when they've got questions about insurance because they're bound to have it? They're bound to have these issues, which is where brokers usually come in. But it seems like the state is going to kind of take that over.
I think the public option advocates are probably still you know, figuring out some of that. And it's getting a little late in the day. But more broadly, we're all aligned on the fact that healthcare costs are going up too fast and health insurance is unaffordable for more and more of our families, our middle class families, our working families and small business. So, you know, we have a plan out there, very clear. Hold the line on drug costs. That's the fastest increasing piece of our healthcare costs there is. You're paying for it every day in your health insurance premium. And, you know, and more importantly, also providing subsidies so more people can afford health insurance on the exchange. Those are two tangible things we're doing to make sure your health care is affordable and accessible.
Right, which everybody certainly can agree on. And I know we're running out of time, Governor. I just wanted to also bring your attention to this bill doesn't really talk about, you know, plan designs or network. It doesn't have details on that. It also kind of doesn't look at the financials since we're already in the red here and kind of how this is going to handle new enrollees to this plan and potential claims and stuff. So I just wanted to make sure that those things are being looked at before we just pass a bill. I think especially the Republican side is worried that when you've got one party majority, they're not sure if their voices are being listened to or opposers of this bill are being listened to. I think that's a big concern.
I'll give you a little good news. We had the lowest increase in health insurance rates, maybe in that, you know, last 30 years, this last year. Really doing a good job there of holding the line. And there are going to be at least one, two, even three additional options on the exchange that will bring down costs and give you more choice. So we're making progress. Too slow for many, but we're making some progress.
Okay. Well, Governor Lamont, we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning. I know you're very busy, so I appreciate it. And we'll talk again in a couple of weeks.
Always great to talk to you, Melissa. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Governor.
What's happening in Washington and how it affects you? Melissa in the Morning. Welcome Congressman Jim Himes to WICC 600.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Yes.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well, thank you. A little sore from way too much snow shoveling, but other than that, I'm doing all right.
I saw your Twitter post where you were out shoveling. I was very impressed. I was like, well, there you go. You know, got to get out.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's the back is only now beginning to, or was only beginning to recover from the, you know, 8-inch version we got a week ago or so.
Yeah, I know,
maybe,
right?
We're not. Maybe I may be old enough to invest in a snowblower at this point.
Oh, you have to. My husband's out snowblowing right now. I can hear him because I'm working from home, and I could hear him out snowblowing. It takes him like 15 minutes versus our usual 2 hours to do the driveway.
There we go.
Yeah, do it. I mean, not that I'm telling you what you need to do, but I would definitely recommend it. Your back will thank you. That's for sure. Of course, everyone's eyes are focused on COVID relief. Where are we at with that? Any updates this morning?
Yeah, so I'm headed down to Washington Monday, and I anticipate that the House will get the big bill done. This is the $1.9 trillion bill. I anticipate that the House will get that bill done in probably the next week or so. And then, it's got to go through the Senate. There'll be debate. I'm sure it'll be slightly changed. But it's a big bill with a lot of aid for our schools so that they can reopen, a lot of aid for our towns and cities. It'll help us keep our property taxes low, a whole bunch of other stuff. And I do anticipate that it'll be done probably by the second week of March. So let's say maybe 3 weeks from now.
Okay, so would people probably start to see that money by the end of March, maybe April, or like how long is that turnaround usually?
Yeah, I think that's right. If the bill gets done in the second week, let's just say second week of March, because we've now sent out two separate economic impact payments, including the $600 that people should have gotten by now because that was in the December bill, mm-hmm. That'll happen quickly. I think you're right. I think it can happen within a week or two of the bill becoming law. And the economic impact payment in this bill is $1,400. So those folks who receive the $600 in December can anticipate, per individual, assuming that they don't exceed the income limits, receiving an additional $1,400 payment.
Okay. And then I know that the last time you and I had connected on this, I think you just said it's a really big bill. And there were parts that I know the Republican side, they're not too fond of, which is kind of, I think, why we're seeing yet another delay in getting some stimulus right now. Do you think there are going to be any changes? Do you see any shifts happening with where the money is being allotted to or what this bill looks like right now?
Yeah, sadly, you're right about this. It would have been nice to see a relief bill, which is really about trying to fix our economic situation and, of course, finally putting an end to this pandemic through lots of money for vaccines and testing and that. It would have been nice to see that be bipartisan. But, the current bill is $1.9 trillion. The Republicans, to their credit, I'm glad they came through with a counteroffer. We're at $600 billion, roughly a third the size or less than a third the size. That's a big gap. And, we saw a jobs report yesterday that said 800,000 plus Americans lost their job in a month. This is a moment where you want to risk doing too much rather than risk doing too little. We're still at, 2,500 deaths a day. I think this probably does not happen on a bipartisan basis. But there will also be changes. The bill currently contains a national increase in the minimum wage to $15 an hour over a period of a couple of years. That is not likely to survive. A number of Democratic senators have said they don't support that. So there's a couple of things that'll get pulled out. And by the way, that won't have an effect on Connecticut because, of course, the Connecticut legislature a couple of years ago passed a path to $15 minimum wage. So,
right.
But I think in terms of the aid that'll go to our people that we just talked about, to our schools and our towns and our cities, that aid will certainly stay in the bill.
Talking to Congressman Jim Himes this morning, and you said the Republicans are putting forward a third of what the Democrats would like to see. So what's the discrepancy there? I mean, that's a big amount of money difference. What are some of the things that like the Republicans are not cool with where the Democrats feel it's important to push debating it further?
Yeah, the big fight over the years, Melissa, has been aid to states and to towns and cities. That's been a Democratic demand for a year. It's always been a no for the Republicans. Mitch McConnell famously called it a blue state bailout, which isn't what it is. One of the mistakes we make in talking about this stuff is calling it state and local aid, right? So why does money go to states and localities? What do states and localities do? They pay policemen. They pay firefighters. Go visit a fire station, as I have done a couple of times. Those guys had to completely change the way they operate, right? Because they go into buildings where people have had heart attacks or to take people out of burning buildings. That means they need new gear. They need, all kinds of new training so that they stay safe. Our teachers, of course, are employees of our towns and cities. They've had to completely change the way they do what they do. So the idea is that the state and local money will go to close the budget gaps that would be created by that expenditure. And, you know, wherever you fall on the Republican-Democratic fight about that, one thing is for sure, which is with this money, the towns and cities we live in will be under a lot less pressure to raise taxes to close deficits.
But are all states going to be getting a bump, or is it just specific states that are getting it?
No. Of course, all states would. And ironically, you know, some of the red states that are represented by Republican senators will end up, you know, doing better probably than some of the wealthier states that are represented by Democrats. And the reason for that, of course, is if you look at a state like Mississippi, which is a very red state, there's a lot of need in a state that has a lot of poverty that we don't see nearly to the same extent in Connecticut. But no, it would be allocated to all states and to all cities and towns over 50,000 people in population.
Okay, so what you're saying is every state, because I think the big thing, like I look at, you know, a lot of the, and of course, this is why I like having a local station, honestly, because I do find that national news sometimes gets skewed depending on which side you stand on. But what you're saying is that what the Democrats would like to do is send money to every state so that you could benefit the same jobs that are in every state. Like, so it's not just blue states that would be getting, you know, money for their police, their teachers, things like that. You're talking about every state, but are you looking at different amounts based on the state? Is it based on per capita? Like, how do you divvy that up? Because is that why Republicans are mad about it?
No, they're mad about it just because they have been convinced that this is some kind of bailout, and it's not. There's two ways the money will be allocated. It'll either be allocated by population, and a lot of the money we've gotten has been allocated that way. In my head, Connecticut has about 1% of the national population. So when you hear a number, we usually get about 1% of that number. So, you know, for example, the $15 billion Save Our Stages number, I would imagine we would get 1% of that, or $150 million. Most things are allocated by population, which is obviously fair. There are some things. So, for example, there's special programs that help schools that are in communities of poverty, right? Mm-hmm. It happens to be called Title I.
Yeah.
So there are some programs that are targeted to cities and areas that have a lot of poverty, school aid, food stamps, that sort of thing, for obvious reasons. You know, it's hard to say who benefits in a situation like that. Obviously, a poor state will get more money. But on the other hand, we have schools, for example, in the city of Bridgeport that get a lot of aid because they serve communities that have a
sure.
lot of poverty in them. So those are the two ways this money is allocated. None of this stuff is allocated by, you know, Nancy Pelosi or Ted Cruz or Jim Himes saying, hey, give my state more. That's
right.
The thing.
But is it something that that the Democrats have been pushing for and should be separated from stimulus money that's not related to COVID? Or do you believe that it is related to COVID, that we need to push it with this bill?
Oh, it's definitely related to COVID. You know, as I was saying, go visit a school right now and you'll see that, you know, they had to buy tons of plexiglass and PPE, and some schools had to buy technology for some of their poorer students so that they could do distance learning. No, this is really about closing gaps that have been created by COVID. You know, including a lot of states make their revenue, including Connecticut, through sales taxes. Well, you know, guess what? Sales taxes in a lot of states are down a lot because, you know, people aren't out eating in restaurants as much as they used to, amongst other things. So it's designed to help close those sorts of deficits as well.
And I don't mean to be redundant. I just really love getting the explanation on this and understanding it and making it known to our listeners as well. So like when you say something, for example, like plexiglass or making schools safer, for example, like isn't that a separate part of the bill, though, that like it's specifically looking at making our schools safer? So then why allocate money to states and local governments if we're already doing that for schools? If that makes sense.
We're doing that in the same bill. you know, again, remember, states and municipalities do a lot of different stuff. We talked about firefighters. You know, again, go visit a fire station. You'll see these guys have had completely changed the way they operate. It's not just schools. And it is also things like, you know, when you see a massive decrease in economic activity, as I just said, your sales taxes go down. States and towns, states generally get their money from sales taxes. When you have a lot less sales tax, you know, states are not permitted to run deficits. So the state faces a choice, right? If you're staring at a deficit, which a lot of states are, they can either raise taxes in that state, which is not a smart thing to do in an economic downturn, because that has the effect of actually increasing the severity of the economic downturn, or you can get some help. And the idea here is that all states ought to get a little bit of help. You know, the economic disaster, the requirement that people stop packing into bars and restaurants, that wasn't anybody's fault. That had to happen because of the COVID, you know, to keep people alive in the context mm-hmm. of COVID. So the idea is that, you know, the states that got very badly hurt because of that ought to get some federal aid.
Well, Congressman Himes, I appreciate you giving us extra time this morning to talk about this. Thank you. And we'll talk again next week. Hopefully you don't have to do more shoveling before then.
That's right. Thank you, Melissa.
All right. We'll talk again next week.
What's happening in Hartford and how it affects you? Senate Republican leader Kevin Kelly joins Melissa in the morning now on WICC 600.
Good morning, Senator Kelly. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Melissa. I'm doing well.
So I wanted to talk actually a little bit about what happened earlier this week, which was the public hearing with the Public Health Committee talking about religious exemptions. And kind of no matter where you stand on the matter, I couldn't help but notice that there was a time cap of 24 hours on that hearing. There was also only a 5-day window for the people who were opposed to the public health option for health insurance. There was only a 5-day window to get that done. I'm noticing these time caps. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but has that always been the case where there are all these like time caps to be able to allow people to speak in opposition of things? Or is this different?
Well, there are some old rules and there's some new rules. And, you know, Melissa, process many times is as important as many of the initiatives, because the process is what allows the people to address their government. And there's a difference here of opinion, I believe, between the two parties. The Republicans believe that it's the people's government. It's the government of the people, by the people, for the people, and therefore we needed an abundance of notice in a virtual legislature so that people would have the ability, because keep in mind, about a quarter of Connecticut don't have connectivity to Wi-Fi, that we need to give people an abundance of notice so that they know what's going on with their government. Democrats feel otherwise. They feel that they're doing great, that people have almost too much notice, because that's why they cut off debate after 24 hours on the vaccine bill, despite the fact that there were still another 1,700 voices that wanted to register their position on the bill. The Democrats believe that they've heard enough, they know enough, they don't have to hear from the people anymore, and want to just proceed with the legislation. In other words, those other 1,700 voices had nothing new to say in their position, and therefore they don't want to hear it.
So my other concern to this, which is why I wanted to talk about this, I wasn't sure if, I mean, especially if you have any inside knowledge to this. It was pretty shocking yesterday that one of our top news stories was the fact that Representative Shredzinski, who represents Monroe in Newtown, another Republican, has decided that he no longer wants to serve the state of Connecticut. He resigned pretty immediately. There was no scandal. There was no drama. It was just, hey, I got to focus on my family and I got to focus on my full-time job. But here's a guy who, this was his fourth term. So he knew he wasn't going to make a lot of money serving the state. He knew how this all kind of worked. And the reporter in me kind of wonders, and maybe I'm wrong, so please call me out if I'm wrong, but I have to wonder if Republicans are feeling defeated because of this idea of like, look, you know, we've kind of made up our minds. We're not even going to bother compromising. We're not going to open the floor to other ideas. Like, if we want to do this because we're a one-party majority rule, that's what we're going to do. Do you believe that, first of all, this, you know, whether it was this representative or in future, we're going to see more of this happening with the Republican Party? Do you think we're nearing a place where, as long as we stick with one party rule, people's voices don't really matter? I hate to ask it that way, but I feel like I need to ask that question.
Well, I don't believe that that's an accurate assessment of what's going on with Representative Schrodinski's position. I think it is a personal and family issue.
Okay.
And look, Melissa, I always believe that good ideas, like our reinsurance idea, like our transportation idea, like the ECS idea that the Democrats are retreating from, good ideas always find friends. And I think that the Republicans have a better way. And I think we will be attracting people to the party once we can focus on Connecticut issues. The Democrats for the past two cycles have been very good at distracting Connecticut from what is really at issue. And that is the unaffordability of Connecticut, whether it's from a tax perspective, whether it's from health care, whether it's regarding our transportation and investment in jobs in our economy. But I believe that when we demonstrate the better way, it's going to resonate with middle-class families because, Melissa, middle-class families are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats are not offering any real solutions. I mean, you take a look at the municipal revenue sharing. Remember the freeze on car taxes?
Sure.
Affordable health care. That was a promise 8 years ago that's never been delivered by Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what our job is going to be is to bring these issues front and center. And when they are, and when Connecticut families look at their own kitchen table economics, I think our message will resonate, and I think our better way is going to show that Connecticut Republicans do have solutions that actually help the middle class as opposed to the lip service they're getting from the Democrats.
And we're talking this morning to State Senator Kevin Kelly. And, you know, you talk about affordability living here in Connecticut, and a lot of people are threatening to leave the state because it truly is not affordable, which you've talked about a lot on the show, which I appreciate. Let's talk about the governor's budget. I noticed a lot of holes in it, quite frankly. For one thing, you know, I was just talking to Senator Blumenthal about this. The governor is betting on federal bailout, just to talk about one of the many things that seemed concerning. But the thing with the federal bailout that I think is interesting is that we saw just with the pandemic that the feds didn't come through for things like PPE. So why are we betting on something like that we're going to get bailed out by the federal government when we've seen in the past that it's going to come down to the state matters?
Well, it's a good talking point, I think. Once again, it's not fulfilling and providing solutions. The budget is supposed to be balanced in accordance with the Constitution, and obviously this isn't. And hoping and praying that they're going to get a bonus at some point in the future from the federal government is just not the way to go about balancing a budget and being fair and respectful to the taxpayer sacrifice. But what's also in there is there's a lot of harm. I talked about education. We came up with a formula in 2017 when the Republicans were tied in the Senate to get away from political decisions with regards to our kids' future that created the largest achievement gap in the country here in Connecticut. The Democrats, we actually put in place a formula that was now based on fairness, equity, and need of the students. The Democrats in this budget are now turning the hands of time back to political decisions and are no longer going to honor that, despite the fact that we got federal money to do it. We have more federal money now in education, but yet they're going to start leaving needy children behind. And that's not a good sign. Another thing they do is they cut what's known as the Medicare Savings Program, which affords seniors the opportunity to purchase preventative health care through the Medicare program. They're going to cut that because they think somebody on $2,000 a month income is too rich, and they want to put an asset test to balance their budget. These are just poor policy choices. It's going to hurt seniors, put more people in nursing homes. We're going to start leaving kids behind, exacerbating an achievement gap. I mean, these are not smart policy decisions, and these are the types of decisions that we're going to bring forward and talk about. And I think when Connecticut middle-class families hear this, they're going to make different choices in 2022.
We were just talking about how the governor's recent budget address sort of has some holes in it, and it really doesn't help the middle class families. First of all, Senator Kelly, do you have any idea how much of Connecticut is made up of middle class families?
Not off the top of my head, no.
I was just curious because I wonder why the people who serve our state don't focus more on middle class. Like I do understand that we have a below, you know, poverty level, you know, amount of people. I know that we do have a richer community as well, but I have to imagine we've got a good amount of Connecticut residents in the middle class that I just feel like are very much getting sideswiped constantly.
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the majority. You know, you have a new Democratic Party that just isn't in tune with the middle class, and they haven't been in tune for quite a while. And it's something that I believe, you know, as far as being a new leader, as well as in the House, we're focused on that. We represent middle class communities. Myself, I've got Shelton, Stratford, Monroe, and Seymour. And, you know, I believe the Republican Party is the voice of the middle class. And that's why I think we're going to see it resonate in 2022.
So what would be your suggestion as opposed to what has been proposed right now for our budget? You know, what do you think would be, you know, something more reliable? What would be better for the middle class families of Connecticut?
Sure. I mean, and we've talked about this one before, but I think this is a big one, is the governor's taxing health and insurance premiums, $75 million. You know, he's going to tax $75 million to reduce premiums. That doesn't make sense. Adding cost in the name of reducing it is not the way to go. And legislative Democrats are offering a public option where we've offered reinsurance, which can do the same reduction in premium, actually gets its arms around the cost of health care, and most importantly, keeps good-paying middle-class jobs here in Connecticut by not going into competition with the private health insurance industry. This brings the relief that Connecticut families have been promised by Democrats 8 years ago. We would deliver on that promise, and it would be more affordable. So that's number one. And we keep jobs because the Connecticut economy is losing jobs. We're the last in the nation in job growth. Number two, transportation comes up every year. And our better way would take money out of our state savings account, which is earmarked for, I'm going to say, our debt relief, our long-term debt, which is crushing Connecticut. We would take that earns relatively little in the savings account, put it on our credit card, if you will, which has a higher interest rate, and with the savings, invest that in transportation. We have done this before. We demonstrate that that would give us the sustainability to have a 21st century transportation system in rail, road, and bridges. But it does it with no tolls, no mileage tax like the governor proposes, no gas tax like the governor proposes. And this would give Connecticut families the ability to go to work without having to pay extra to do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is important, as well as and today, Melissa's National Caregiver Day. And we need to give a shout out and a thank you to all caregivers. But building a better, robust aging in place network. Seniors want to age in place. It's one third the cost from Medicaid's perspective to age in place as opposed to a nursing home.
Sure, of course.
This governor, like his initiative with the Medicare Savings Program, and the Democrats continue to put impediments in the way of making a robust and healthy home care system. These are initiatives that families want. When I talk to seniors, I'm going to tell you 90% want to age in place at home.
Of course they do.
Right. It's cheaper. And showing what happened with COVID, it's better.
Of course.
Why aren't we doing it? It's common sense. But this is not what the Democrats are offering the middle class. We are offering a better way. And I think if people trusted Republicans here in Connecticut, which are different from those in Washington, I think they would feel the relief and the solutions that they've been asking for.
Well, Senator Kevin Kelly, I always appreciate your transparency and breaking this stuff down for us. Thank you so much, and I look forward to talking again next week.
You bet. Thank you very much, Melissa.
It's time to go beyond the classroom and check in with the Discovery Museum. It's science you may not know on WICC 600.
No, don't worry. It is still Friday. It's not a Wednesday, but I had to have David Mestre back on this morning because we did it, David. The Perseverance, it landed on Mars.
Oh, it's so exciting. Yeah, we are definitely on Mars, and we're ready to get started and do some exciting science. But yeah, it was so a nail-biter. Cool. It was definitely a nail-biter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I replayed our interview yesterday for everyone before the afternoon because I was like, let me just have David go back through how stressful these 7 minutes are going to be. But we did it. So now what happens? Like, what can we look forward to? What's the work that's going to be done?
Well, this is really an exciting mission. So there are a couple things that that are going to be done. First, they're actually going to do a systems check and do a commissioning stage. So they're just going to make sure that everything's working properly, and then eventually they're going to start to unpack all of its instruments. And it's got a camera that's going to be like a dual camera that can do 3D pictures of the surface. And it actually, this camera actually is able to zoom, so it's a zoomable camera. So we're gonna get some really good footage of the surface. We've got a number of different experiments that we're gonna work on. One of the most important parts of the mission for Perseverance is to search for what we call biosignatures. These are either signs of present life, or more likely maybe, or signs of a past life. And so we sent Perseverance to this crater, Jezero crater, because it was actually at one time underwater. So this was actually filled with water. And there is a layer of clay, we think it's probably about 3,000 feet deep, that we're going to be examining the rocks to see if there are any clues that at one time in the past, the watery past of Mars, there might actually have been life. So that's one of the big parts of the mission, the astrobiology mission. And then we're also doing a couple of other really cool technology demonstrations. So for me, one of my favorites is that for the first time, we're going to send a small helicopter to Mars.
Yes. And yes.
Yeah, so this is so going to cool. be super cool. So Ingenuity on its tummy actually has packed a small helicopter. And this tiny helicopter has super big blades, primarily because the air is so thin that these blades have to spin faster, and they actually have to be larger in order for them to get the necessary lift to be able to fly. Now that's probably going to be about a month away, so stay tuned. But eventually, when all systems are clear, they're going to power up this helicopter, and Perseverance will gently lower the helicopter onto the ground and then just back away. And then they're going to turn it on, and then it's going to start flying, hopefully. And it'll all do this by itself because there's an 11-minute time delay at least when, you know, and it will get worse, you know, as time goes by, as we get moving further and further away from the planet Mars as our mm-hmm. orbits start to dance around the sun. And so we're just going to send these commands. We're going to wait, and it could probably be even as much as like a half hour before we even know whether it flew or crashed. So that's where everybody's kind of like on their pins and needles. Yeah, when Perseverance landed, we got the news that it landed at 3:55. So we're so excited, and you saw all these engineers at Jet Propulsion Laboratory. They're all whooping it up, you know, as you know, they can whoop it up. They can get excited.
Totally.
But Perseverance was already on the ground by that time.
That's so funny.
Didn't know what.
Yeah.
So it actually had landed at 3:44, and we just had to wait 11 minutes before we actually got the confirmation that it actually landed.
So stressful. Now, the question I have at this point, David, is Perseverance is going to be up there for like, what, 2 years doing work? Is that my understanding?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the base mission. Exactly. So we'll start with 2 years, but we have found that some of this hardware can actually last a really long time. So we believe that further funding and more scientific opportunities that become available as we extend the mission, this thing could be up there for well over 2 years. So it could probably be as many as 10 years.
Okay, and we don't need it to come back to Earth for us to look at these findings or anything. We literally could watch in real time what's going on up there.
In a sense, yes. So what will happen is that we will get all this data and information and imagery transmitted back with a time delay, of course, but it'll be enough to be able to kind of whet our appetites. But if we're really looking for biosignatures, the instruments that Perseverance have will not definitively prove that life actually existed. It can give us hints that it might have existed, but it won't prove it. To really prove it, we need to bring back a sample from Mars and use much larger laboratory equipment to be able to determine that. And so Perseverance has a solution. Okay, we thought about this. What Perseverance is going to do is that if there is a particular sample that has gotten astrobiologists really excited, the Perseverance rover will be able to collect that sample and stow it in a capsule and leave it on the surface for another mission to go find it and bring it back to Earth.
Got it. Okay. All right. So we won't have to wait the duration of how long it's up there.
That's right. I mean, it may be a while before we can get those really interesting samples back. And we are in development now of a sample return mission. But the big first step was to get Perseverance there with all this equipment to be able to collect those samples and leave them ready for collection later return mission. So that's the cool thing. So if there's a really cool sample that we just don't have the instruments on Perseverance to really analyze well, to really answer that question, Perseverance is equipped to be able to stow that sample and put it into a container and then just, you know, like little droppings on the surface of Mars, and just kind of leave it there and wait for another mission in the future to collect those samples and then bring them back, pristine samples, back to Earth.
The important thing is
we got to make sure that we didn't accidentally bring, life to Mars. And so there's an engineer. Her name is Mugiga Cooper. Her job is to make sure that there are no bugs hitching a ride on that rover. So she's going to make sure it's super clean.
Okay, perfect. I was going to say, unfortunately, David, we've run out of time, but I'm hoping maybe we can dive more into this next week, because I know people are amped on this, and we would love to continue talking about it.
Absolutely. I'm more than happy to do that.
Awesome. Thank you so much, David, for coming back on again this week, and congratulations. A very big success right here, and we'll continue to track what's going on next.
Great.